Welcome to another episode of Zista Podcast, where we invite industry leaders and academicians to answer questions that students have within a particular area. Today we're focusing on game design and development, and joining us today is Abhinav from Zathum Games. Welcome to the podcast, Abhinav.
Hi, Matt. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Firstly, let me start by saying thank you for making time to come on the podcast. We're delighted that you're joining us here today. As a good starting point, would you like to maybe begin with a small introduction, a small background about what you've been doing and a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Okay, so first of all, thanks a lot for having me here. And I think it's a great pleasure to be on this platform. To give a brief, I'll just explain it that I'm the CEO and founder of Zathum, and I'm a director at Glow Metaverse Private Limited. I started Zathum in 2007, and we started off doing services, then moved to IP. And over the years, we have worked with some of us global companies like 2K, Wargaming, Disney, Ubisoft, Gameloft, Netbubble, Roster, etc. And on the IP side of things, we started doing games for PC, then moved to mobile, then VR. And we've been focused in the VR space since last 6-7 years. And our last VR game got released on almost 6 platforms, including PlayStation 1, PlayStation PlayStation VR 1, PlayStation VR 2. And the current games we are developing, one is on console and PC. The game is on VR for MetaQuest 3. On with Hollow Metaverse, it's an Indo-Japanese collaboration where my director is Japanese, and we are trying to bring his expertise in VR and entertainment and my expertise in gaming and VR as a social gaming metaverse app for the Indian audiences.
Sounds really interesting. And I'm sure you got your hands full, you know, juggling so many projects, I'm sure would be, you know, quite a task.
It is.
To get things started, I wanted to ask you, could you share the story behind starting Zathum, you know, and how have you managed to grow it into the successful company that it is today?
Right, so I never thought I'd start my own company. As a matter of fact, I never wanted to go into games. I graduated from Vancouver Film School as a 3D animator, and I wanted to go into animation. But after doing my diploma in 3D animation from Vancouver Film School, I came back to India, worked in Mumbai in a gaming company. And that's how the gaming bug hit me. And then I again went back to Vancouver and got a job at Ubisoft Montreal, where I was working multiple titles under Ubisoft. And there, a friend of mine was Swedish, and we both thought to, you know, start a gaming company. So I said, we'll go to India and start a gaming company. And I came back to India in 2006, and he also came down here, but he couldn't, he couldn't find the weather and everything to his liking, so he left. And I stayed behind, and in 2007, I started this company. And when I started off, I didn't have any grand visions like, you know, this is what you want to do. We just went ahead with the flow because, you know, the video game industry is very dynamic. It's very changing. So you cannot have like a very 5-year fixed plan, right? Because it just keeps on changing each and every time, right? So what we did was that since outsourcing was picking up at that time, we started doing that. While working with clients, we realized that how come when we do work for clients, or what we do work for ourselves as well. That's how we went into IP creation. We released our first game called The Legend of Buzz in 2010. And that game, even though it wasn't a huge financial success, but it got us a lot of recognition globally. It was way ahead of its time, way back in then. And what we realized that, you know, we saw a lot of opportunities with, say, Facebook gaming, with iOS store, with Android store, with freemium, with free to play. And there were some trends that we missed. So when VR came out in 2016, we were following VR very closely. So that's why we decided to jump into VR before the rest of the crowd. And I think we are one of the very few companies in India which has multiple games in VR on under the IP for various platforms. And I think the main thing is that since the industry is so dynamic, it's so ever-changing, you have to constantly keep on leveraging your skills and pivoting towards what the trends might be. And so that's what we have done. And now I think PC and console is again picking up. So we are on that side as well. Now, one other thing is that, you know, normally studios pick the strengths in terms of what Shardas they work with and what platforms they work with. So we started doing PC casual, sort of mid-core, and moved to mobile casual and mobile hardcore games.
Sure.
Then moved to VR hardcore. So people constantly tell us that, you know, our last VR game, was a fighting game. The game before that was a VR sniper game.
Okay.
The game before that was a VR was a Infinite Runner iOS Android game. The game after that was iOS Android shooting game. The game that we're currently working on right now is a horror game for PC, and our other game is a fantasy game. So people keep on asking us, why do you keep changing so many genres and platforms? Had we stuck to a single genre, it would have been good. But because we experiment with so many genres and platforms, our skills have vastly increased. And now we know what works where. So we are using that to leverage and to push ourselves to the next level.
It's really nice to hear that. You know, staying ahead of the curve is so important. And it's so interesting to hear you talk about how you adopted VR much sooner than, say, maybe your peers. And today you're benefiting as a result of that. Talking about trends, I just wanted to ask you, looking at, say, the short to mid-term horizon, and I'm saying short to mid-term because the industry itself is so dynamic, what are some of the trends do you foresee coming to bear, you know, in the near future that I think people would benefit hearing about?
So I think, you know, AI is going to come over and AI is going to really kick ass. I think that's for sure. It's already happening. You know, be it concept design, be it ideation, be it prototyping, a lot of things are being taken over by AI. And I think AI, so companies like EA, which is massive, they are using AI to, for them, a stadium which took them 6 months, they are doing that in 6 weeks. So it's changing the entire dynamic. And what is happening is that because it's changing the dynamic, the skills required now are a lot different. It doesn't matter what softwares you know. You should know what AI tools work where and how to utilize them to your benefit, so that when you get in the industry, you kind of don't become an added burden, but become an added skill to kind of, you know, push yourself ahead. So AI is already creeping up very fast. And I think it's affecting each and every segment and department of the industry. The second is VR is going to come up pretty big, VR and AI both. Of course, Apple Vision Pro didn't do that well, but I mean, Apple being Apple, they're not going to go down so lightly. So I think over the next few years, we're going to see Apple kind of dominate the VR space pretty big. And even Meta Quest 3, I think they're coming out with a new headset. A lot of people are looking at it because that's the next frontier. Mobile games have taken a very big hit because, of course, marketing for mobile is very expensive. So I think we're going to see the rise of PC and console games coming forward. Right. Also, a lot of serious gaming like education, learning, simulation, defense. I think those are areas where, you know, VR is already assisting, but will assist a lot further. One thing I'd also like to mention is health. Health and medicine is where VR is being used extensively for training purposes. So it's already being used very extensively. It's coming to a point where, you know, people might not even need to attend like a nurse's school. They might just put a headset and just kind of check out everything around.
Because it's so interesting to hear you talk about this, you know. You know, just the other day, I was listening to a lovely podcast on TED AI, and they were talking about how AI NPCs or non-playable characters in games are really getting more conversational capabilities using large language models. So it was so interesting to see the evolution of those NPCs and how going forward they'll play an even more important role and evolve with a user as he or she is playing the game. So that's really interesting, again, as a development.
It is because, you know, I think that is one of the, I gave a session talk in Bangalore earlier this month, and that was about AI. So there were like, there was in-world AI, there's promotion AI. So you have NPC characters, which kind of you can add, you can engage in the play with the dialogue. Based on the narrative that you decide and the interaction that they have with the player, a lot more dynamic, a lot more interactive, right? And AI can now not only look at what the player is doing, but they can decide on the player behavior as to how the game should be. Should it be more difficult? Should it be more challenging? They can change the narrative based on the player. Right. And also, I think one thing will be which AI will also affect us. I mean, I'm sure this is already happening. A lot of studios or companies are already pushing all the data that they have into AI to see what trends will work in the future. Right. So they're looking at player behavior, player analytics, and everything. So all that data. So I think there's going to be a lot more data driven approach in our video games quite soon.
Super. And the world is going to be increasingly more complex, but in a way, all of this data and AI is actually going to simplify stuff and maybe even personalize the gaming experience, right?
It is. I think at the end of it, I think what it will do is that, so AI has helped both. I mean, AI has helped smaller studios, AI has helped larger studios. It's brought everyone under a single platform. For larger studios, it helps them streamline the processes. For smaller studios, it's made them do what they never have been possible, like compete with the big guys. So at the end of the day, it's going to make everyone on a single platform. But that said, I think what's going to happen is that the amount of players are limited, right? You have 100 players. You're not going to get 500 players the very next day. So then everyone is competing for players' attention. Then how do you make sure that the player plays your game and not your competitor's game? I think that is the biggest question that's going to be there, right? So, I mean, we have seen some very big multi-million dollar, $200 million, $10 million games flop. We have seen some very low-budget indie games do very well. Yeah.
Just a few weeks ago, and I hope I have not got that timeline wrong, but just a few weeks ago on Twitter, there was a big buzz on how an AI engine was trained frame by frame on an older game like Doom, and it could recreate the next frame of the game and the next frame of the game. So it was managed completely by AI without the use of an engine like Unreal, for example. And, you know, it got people questioning that whether in the future, if you train an AI model on specific frames that you've developed within a game, whether it can anticipate and build the next frame out for you without the need for a game engine.
Yeah, that's interesting. But again, you know, I think there is a difference between doing a small demo and doing an actual game. Right.
Sure.
There's an entire different kind of pipeline associated with that. But yeah, I think it's good because people are trying it a lot. And I think this goes for everyone in the industry. Like, whoever will be able to leverage AI to their benefit, right? They will be the ones who will be coming out as a winner. It's as simple as that. And with AI, I think it's both how much you can push it as well as how much you can benefit from it, right? And so it's going to change a lot of things. And I think all those who are going to have, like for No Man's Sky, they used AI to build their worlds, right? So they don't need a team of 100 people or 500 people to build their worlds.
Sure.
So if you have a smaller teams that use AI to create content, that makes you a lot more efficient than, you know, studios having 500 people to do the same thing. Right. So I think that is where, yeah, that is where the main thing will be. But yeah, what you're saying, that's great. I haven't seen the video, to be honest. But I would not be surprised if maybe now in the future people are able to recreate AAA games much faster with a much higher quality in a short span. But again, everything comes back to the same point that if you have 5 games coming out which use previous games look and story and content and work and details, those games are all going to look similar. Right. So then how do you differentiate that?
Sure.
Right.
True that.
Right.
Yeah, but it's one thing which is really interesting to see is how AI is really acting as a leveler, you know, and I think this is true across domains, and game development is no exception there, that AI is really acting as a great leveler of sorts. So the smaller studios with, you know, good AI tools and
right.
good thinking, of course, along with that, it's not just AI. There's a lot of good thinking that's going along with the AI, are able to compete with some larger studios. And I think that's such an enabler. It really presents a bright prospect for smaller, younger studios.
True. I mean, that's true. I think with AI tools, you can create concepts, you can create levels, you can prototype, you can create art assets. You can do a lot more with smaller team. And that kind of gives you the power. I think at the end of the day, it's going to allow a single solo developer to compete with a, say, a Fortune $500 billion company. So that's where AI is going to end. Right. So that is where the end looks like that. A single person can make the entire game on his or her own time and can make sure that that game is competing with $500 million or $1 billion studio.
Right. Oh, one thing which is something that gamers will really benefit from is if that game development timeline, and we know good quality, you know, games do take a lot of time to develop. A lot of blood, sweat, and tears goes back into making a fantastic game. If that timeline can be crunched, I'm sure it'll allow people to hit the market sooner. And interestingly, for gamers, they can actually get access to such high quality games at a much faster pace than what they've had in the past. So that's also a really good development in the industry.
Yeah, I think it's great because now I think people are spoiled for choice, right? Because now they have like 100 different games to try on. And I think what's happened now is that game development is not just making games, it's order looking games. I think there's a lot of, I think this goes back to each and everything. But I think in the video game industry, I think marketing is a huge part.
Sure.
Your development might be 20%, but marketing has to be 70%. And you need to build a community, you need to build a team, you need to build an audience that cares about the game. I think you cannot just say, I've made a game and I launch it and tomorrow I make $1 billion or something. It doesn't work that way. Mobile, it's even more harder because when it's for hyper casual games, you're looking at budgets of anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 a month. This is marketing. So those are very high budgets, right? For PCIe, for PCO, you're going to get anywhere from $5 to $27 a month for marketing or 4 or 5 months. So marketing is a huge cost.
Sure.
So coming back to the main question, yeah, gamers would have it nice, but someone needs to go and tell the gamer that here's a game, right? So for that, you need to have marketing. So while gamers will be spoiled for choice, I think studios, I think that includes us, I think they all have to look at marketing from a very different point of view, that what audience to our target. So earlier, what we used to do is we used to make a game and then find an audience. For the current games, we have an audience and then we found an audience and then we have a game fun.
In the context of a game, you know, it can be a chicken and egg situation. Do you first look at the market, sense that there's a need for a game of a particular type or genre and then go about developing it? Or do you first develop a game and then look for a market that can consume it? What's your view there?
I think we used to do these second first, and then we sort of got our hands, because what is happening if you make a game and then try to look for an audience, it doesn't work that way. Because, you know, then you have to kind of sort the audience according to the game. And that's not how things work, because then different audiences might have different preferences. So that doesn't work that way. And we tried that, because then, you know, 100 people have a different opinion of how the game should be. But if you pick an audience, which is a very famous audience, has over 1 million fans. They have different, they of course have a lot of games done there, but they don't have the game that which you are making. They don't have that game on console. So then you have a niche that I'm making a game on console, which the story, which has not been done before. And then I have 1 million fans who might be interested in it. So that approach works a lot better rather than I make a game and then find 1 million fans.
Right. Absolutely. Sounds like a sound strategy. And thanks for sharing that. You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about education, you know. Can you tell me about how your education has helped you in your journey, you know, today, in the profession that you are, in the person that you are? If you could just talk about that, it would help.
Right. So, you know, I, after 12, I did a lot of things. I did my first year Bachelor of Science. I did my French diploma, I did my IT course, and I was doing my animation, so I did a bunch of things. But I think my learning at Wealth Course from school helped me a lot, because that was a very intense course. It was almost a 3-year course back in 1 year.
Okay.
Not super intense. And actually, I was self-learned, because I started learning basically 3 softwares. And within 6 months, I knew much more than what my tutors did here in India. So, but when I worked at Ubisoft, I found out that, you know, since when you work in a big company, you're only doing one part of the thing, not the entire thing.
Sure.
Right? So your kind of focus is very narrow. So you tend to sort of lose some skills, right? So what I've found out is that, and again, while running a business, I didn't have any skills to run the business because my background was as from games, right? And jumping into business was a totally different thing. So I learned everything on the go. But I think if you're eager to learn, if you are okay with making mistakes, I never looked at it as, you know, a 5-year thing that I'll do it for 5 years and then I'll do it. So because I've been in the industry for a long time, I can now foresee trends and I can now look at what might be working ahead. That, and all of this is because of what I've gone through. So education can only teach you that this is a knife, this is a fork, this is how you cut it.
Sure.
What more you have to do is on your own. And that no tutor can teach you. That's all your passion. That's all your learning. That's all your interest, right? So no education, no school in the world will teach you 100 ways that a fork and knife can be used, right? They'll not teach you what else is to do with them. That's all on you, right? And my learning has been this, and it's very clear because I've had people in my studio who have dropped out of college, who were self-taught, and those who have done their Bachelor of Fine Arts, Master of Fine Arts, those who have done here from IITs and stuff. I found that all those who are self-taught, they are doing much better because they are able to adapt a lot faster. So your ability to adapt to different technologies, your ability to learn new technologies, your ability to move forward counts a lot, especially in this industry. And a lot of students I meet, right, and I'm sorry if I'm going a bit off topic. I have met students from all the colleges that you can think of. A lot of time I see their work and the work is pretty okay. And then I ask them, how come your work is not that good? And they say the institutes don't teach. I mean, institutes are not supposed to teach you everything. They're able to tell you that this is what the course is. Just you have to learn your own. Right. No one is gonna sit down and tell you how to model a face. You have YouTube. Go on YouTube and just check it out. So learn as much as you can on your own because this industry is for self-learning, right? With AI coming in, this industry is not prepared. How will the education institutes or colleges? I mean, they cannot expect to be prepared. My studios themselves are not ready for everything, right? So your learning has to be pretty strong. Your interest has to be pretty strong. If you're interested, then your learnings will kind of help you take forward, right? Because no one can teach you everything. Whatever you learn in school, within 2 or 3 years in the industry, all that learning goes away, right? Because what you learn in from school, suppose you from school, you from any institute, you come out as a 3D animator or a 3D modeler, and then you're working in, say, vehicles, or you're working on characters, or you're doing animation. Whatever you learned in school doesn't apply over there. So the industry knowledge applies over there. Your school knowledge is only there to get you to point A. From point A to point B, it's your thing that your portfolio counts, right? If you have a class of 30 students, how come 25 people have portfolios that suck? Now, and how come 2 people have portfolios that are completely amazing?
Absolutely.
Right. So why is that? The tutor is the same. Everyone is the same. So everything comes on the interest, right? How much interest you have, how much you need to learn. So coming back to the main topic, education is important. But if you're self-taught, that's much better. Education can only teach you what tools to use. Because when you jump in the industry, so the processes we use are different. Companies, each and every studio has their own processes. So a person working here, when he goes to a different studio, the processes might change with it. So the education only prepares you to go from point A to point B. It doesn't prepare you for the entire lifetime. I don't recall what I learned at school. Right, no one does. Because the moment you jump into the industry, things change, right? Software change. Forget everything.
Sure. Sure.
Right. So yeah. Sorry, I mean, if I went a bit off topic.
No, I really enjoyed whatever you covered. And I think, you know, you touched upon a very interesting point, you know, Abhinav. So you were talking about, in a way, also about the skills and mindsets that self-part.
Yes.
The exceptional student, the exceptional performer from the average. So if you don't mind, let's just go a little deeper into that.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm a person who really wants to be an exceptional student, really wants to have a stunning portfolio. And you've actually said that, okay, don't just limit yourself to your education, your curriculum. Please definitely go out there and learn extra, do more. But if there are some other things that you can add in along the same lines, I'd love to hear your views as to what can students do, either from a mindset perspective or from a practice perspective, that can help them get better.
Amit, I think this is a very big problem. I think I was talking with a podcaster, Swahan from the UK. I think he had it Boston. He had his podcast, and I told him the same thing, and a couple of other people as well when I had a podcast with that. The biggest problem with people is the expectations.
Sure.
Right? So if my portfolio is okay, I don't want to work for a small company. I want to work with the biggest company out there. I want to work with the biggest name out there.
Sure.
Right? I don't want to work with a small company where I can build my skills. No, that is not my level. Right? Wo company mein level ki nahi hai. I am at a different level. I'm not gonna do this. Till I get a job at XYZ, Pixar, till I get a job at Rockstar, my first job, I'm not gonna do anything else. So that mentality is wrong. And that is what I find in a lot of students, and I think that is completely wrong. That should go out. First thing is, you have your portfolio ready. Find any job you can get. Get inside the industry. Even a small company or small studio which is doing some basic 3D work or whatever work they are doing, at least they have some insights. They're not stupid that they have opened a studio.
Sure.
Right. Whether they are in Indore or in Pune or in Guwahati or in whatever place they are, they have some sense, right, that what is going on. Right. I have had people who came to me had a really good work, but they didn't want to join a studio because they wanted to work with the best studios out there. And they have wasted years doing it. Working on portfolios, changing careers, doing this, doing that. And I'm like, amazed that, you know, the amount of time you wasted doing this stuff, you could have got a job somewhere else, build up your experience. Because experience counts much more than your education over here in this industry. Let's be very clear. You can spend 6 years building your education, or you can do 2 years building education and do 4 years experience. Take your resume out and see which one works. Right. Experience will always win over you. Education, unless until your portfolio is to that next level, then it's a different thing.
Sure. So
I would advise people, first and foremost, to have a very, very open mentality. Pick any job that they get. That's number one. Secondly, if they want to go ahead in the industry, then see what games they like, which studios make those games, which studios make those games, what software they use, what processors they use, what are the skill sets that they are looking for, and then how can I acquire those skill sets? Because you cannot apply the same portfolio to different companies and you will not get it.
Makes sense.
Right. So figure out what you want, right? If you like games from, Rockstar, if you like games from, say, Naughty Dog, or, you know, if you like games from, say, Splash
Games.
Yeah, Epic Games. Pick out the games that you like. If you like very stylized games from, say, Media Molecule, that's fine. Pick out games that you like. Pick out studios which have developed those games. Figure out what they have done. What are they making on? Because a company making a casual game has a very different approach to everything compared to a company making super stylish AAA. They are worlds apart. So figure out where you want to work, right? And then you apply over. Right? And if you don't get in, that's fine. Get any job that you can get. And if you get a graphic design job, screw it. Take that. Jump in somewhere. Because your experience, at least you will learn something there, right? Whatever you might learn, you learn something other than being at home and working on your portfolio. You can always work in a portfolio after you come back home, but get some experience. That is what I tell people, because, you know, I have had people who have had like a year's break or a couple of years break because, you know, they wanted to stop and work on a portfolio or things didn't work out. That's fine. But when we hire them, we find that, you know, it takes them a lot of time to come back to the routine which a regular artist have. Because at break, it doesn't serve good because, you know, the break that they have, it doesn't kind of match the skills to be required. It takes them at least, even if they have like 4 years of experience, but a 6-month break will really kind of push them really back and not allow them to what do you call, have the same speed or have the same skill set as the regular Atlas champs. That is just my experience. I could be wrong, but students who are interested, figure out what you want to do. If you like anatomy, work on that. If you like art surfaces, work on that. If you like animation, work on that. Figure out what AI tools are there which help you, right? So, I mean, there's so much information out there. You cannot, a single person cannot do everything, okay? You cannot model characters, cars, vehicles, environments, put everything. So that's how I work. Figure out what your skill set is. Figure out whether you like characters, you like anatomy, you like your art surface, you like whatever your style is that you like. Also, one most important thing is, and I think this goes, this is again what I keep telling on to almost all the podcasts that I have. It's no longer enough to have just a model rotating around. Those days are gone. Now you need to have a model inside the Unity or the Epic engine, Unreal engine, with the lighting, with the actual scenes, with everything. So that shows that you are a person who can not only model art, who can not only create art, but can also put it inside the engine, now can also make it run inside the engine. All right, so that puts your skill set to a very different level compared to other artists.
Makes sense. I really like the realistic advice and feedback that you're sharing, and I'm sure students who tune into the podcast will really appreciate hearing this. And I think, in a way, students can have a realistic assessment of their own portfolio. Looking at their portfolio, looking at the portfolio of their peers, they can clearly make out where they stand and do a realistic assessment there, right? To know whether, okay, what I'm doing is really good or much better than my peers, or it's pretty much in line with my peers.
Okay.
And therefore, drumming down, understanding what you want to work on, going deeper, understanding the players, the technologies, the tools, the software, getting familiar with that, making sure that you have your A-game sorted, and then actually going further into the industry. So all the points that you actually said made a lot of sense. And thank you for laying it out so nicely, you know, Abhinav.
Yeah, I think it's a pleasure because people have a very different, students have a very different mindset. So I'll not name any colleges. So we had students from a college come in over here and you know, they came in, they went to the studio, it was a studio visit, and then, you know, they all showed their portfolio, then I gave them feedback that, you know, the portfolio you have, they are pretty basic. So I think you need to change on that. But the problem is that no one wants to change on that, right? Because the work that they have done is good enough. But it's not good enough to get them a job, right? Because I think the best thing that they can do is suppose that for whatever studio they're applying, just go and check what work they're doing. If their work doesn't match to the studio that they're applying, how will the studio hire them, right? And also forget the studio, just go on artstation.com. Just see what work is being done over there. So at least get your level 2 that mark, right? And with Jack, GTB and everything, it's so easy right now to code. It's so easy right now to get feedback. It's so easy right now to see which studios are doing what are the requirements. I mean, there's so much stuff we can do now. Right. So, I mean, just use that to your advantage, right? I mean, ultimately, all of this research is just going to help you. It's not going to help anyone else, right?
And I'm sure this is something that employers also will appreciate. So, suppose there's a student who's prepared, who's done his or her background, saying, sir, madam, I've checked this. I saw that.
Right.
You're using this. I've seen your outputs. And I think I can produce something which is pretty much, or at least maybe I require a little mentorship. Because let's be honest, in some cases, students may need a little mentorship from people in the industry to take their outputs to say what is actually being used in the industry. That's fair, right? I mean, that's a fair ask.
True. And you know, we have had candidates who we normally give a test out, and you know, we have had candidates whose test was 50-50, but we went with a hunch, and now then their work, through all of the, you know, I think, not mentorship, but through our guidance. I think their work now is super kick-ass. So as studios also, you need to give chances to candidates. Even if their work is not 100% match, but if it's a 50% match, right? Then, okay, that's a call that you should take. Okay, if I remain this person going ahead, this person will really move to the next level. That's a risk that even the studios are taking. But that risk pays off because, you know, I have found out that with decent guidance, within 2 or 3 months, people are able to really perform really well, right? Even if the test is not up to the mark, but the moment they get in, because they sit and learn from the colleagues and everyone and the peers around them,
sure.
We're able to kind of push very far.
Sure. I had a few more questions,
right.
And I'm really enjoying this discussion, I must say. So let's say you're given a choice. Now, that choice is obviously not available to everyone, but let's say you're given a choice to join a large studio and work on a very small part of you know, the overall game development process, versus joining a smaller studio and taking on a bigger chunk of the work. When you're starting your career, which option do you think students should give more preference to?
So, of course, so if I'm being practical, I think the largest studio will, of course, pay a lot more. Right? Let's be honest about that. So the package over there will be a lot higher. But the problem is, if you start your career learning only one part of the food chain, not the entire food chain.
Sure.
Which is great. But as you move up ahead, because I've had friends working with very bigger studios where they spent 6 months or 1 year just working on heads. That's it. Nothing else. Just working on heads. After 1 year, you should see how frustrated they were, because you don't know anything else. That's all you're doing day in, day out. That's a machine job, right?
Sure.
Compared to a smaller studio where you get a lot more exposure, you learn a lot more about the processes. You learn a lot more how to handle things, which of course, when you move to other studios, it really helps you a lot more.
Right.
Right. In larger studios, you don't have any control as to what the final output might be. In smaller studios, you can give your feedback, your greatest feedback. Like, how about we do this? How about we do that? In larger studios, do you think that they will listen to what you have to say? No way. Right? In smaller studios, you can say, how about we do this? Or how about we do that? Or how about we add to this game? Or how about this game has such a great feature? How about we implement it? I mean, we listen. Right? Smaller studios, they wouldn't, larger studios, you wouldn't tell them how the feature and everything. They'll just tell them, hey, you know what? Amazing.
We didn't hire you for this. Do the job we hired you for.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we have expert team of game designers who know what they're doing. So I think we should give it to them. That's how it ends.
Nice, polite answer.
Yeah.
But the point is clear.
Very clear.
Yeah. All right. Okay. As the last question I'd like to ask you, Abhinav. Now, as someone who's hiring people to join the industry, you know, what is it that you look for in new employees? I think if you, give some info on that, it will really help people understand how they can be better prepared for an interview.
Right. So I think first of the portfolio, your portfolio has to be very kick-ass, right? Also, I see this a lot often. These people go online and they put other people's work in there. So that should not happen.
Yeah.
Right, because, you know, it's easy, so easy to pick it up, because, you know, when we see a portfolio which has 3 amazing images and 3 not so good images, we can make it out, okay, this guy has taken this from somewhere else.
Sure.
But that's evident. And at one time, one guy sent a portfolio. His work included our work.
Really?
Yeah. So he had put our work inside his portfolio. I'm like, amazing. So you worked on this? And that guy said, yes. Then I said, you worked on this. Then how come you're not with us? Because it's other work. So it was just crazy, right?
Oh my God.
So don't do that. So portfolio is first, portfolio counts a lot. Second is that we also see how much a person is willing, because, you know, we cannot teach softwares. So I think ZBrush is a must. Your Max IR Etherwork is a must. You should know Marvelous and Painter. So we look at certain softwares that this softwares person should know. If they're able to put it into the engine, they're able to make it work, that's fine. We're not expecting person to know everything, but to at least show the promise that they can learn everything and they can go to the next mile. That is what we're looking at. And again, because, you know, at times when we are looking to hire, we get almost hundreds of resumes in a span of a week. So it's very hard for us to kind of, you know, check it out. So I think the best thing to do would be to please make sure that your resume is detailed. It has a link to your portfolio. Please mention correctly as to what you're working on, whether you have any experience or not, and just share a link to your portfolio. And being a student, please make sure that you put your best work in. I don't need to go to a 10-minute demo. I don't have time for that. No other time for that. Just put your best images over there. That's it, right? And also, I think go to artstation.com, see how they're presenting. right? Because a presentation can't, based on the presentation of your work, you're going to get hired, right? Putting a few model turnarounds or, you know, proof of concept models without any textures isn't going to get you a job, right? So if you spend 3 months or 6 months working on a portfolio, spend 2 weeks making sure that the presentation on this portfolio is good.
Absolutely.
Right? Right. And that applies to us as well, because tomorrow, today, when we are presenting clients our work, we cannot show them, you know, anything. We also have to be sure that our portfolio looks good, it has detail, it shows what the work that you have done, everything. So that applies to us as well. Right. So and this is a long process. So please make sure that your presentation skills are good. We're able to showcase that this is the work you can do. And this is the work that you can do without any external support from DMA. Right. So if I give you this work tomorrow, when you join, you can do it.
Right.
Right. I don't have to train you on this. Right. Right. And also apply for the position that, so if someone is booked character, don't apply as an animator. If someone is a for animators, don't apply as a character. And again, show other skills, like, you know, if you can paint, show that. If you can, you know, put it inside the engine and make it work and light and everything, perfect. That, right? It's a lot more easier now. So show, the more things you show, the better chances of are there for you getting hired, right? And the thing is, if we may not hire you right now, but we'll always kind of ask you, you know what, your work is good, but it still doesn't add that. How about, you know, you kind of apply back to us again in the next 3 months, 6 months when we have an opening where we might not need such a detailed artist, we can look at your work then, right? So I think that really helps, right? So yeah, but do, I know it's a lot of things that I mentioned, but if you can do that, the chances of getting hired are exponentially increasing everywhere, right? Not just us, each and every studio will be looking for.
Sure. But
emails, so we don't know. There were some people who had amazing portfolios, but they didn't have any emails of contact. So how do you get back to them? All
right. Yeah, some practical tips, right? I mean, very, very basic ones, but that you would expect that everyone would have in place. But, you know, I'm
right.
Surprised that that you got a resume with a great portfolio, but no email.
Right. So,
yeah.
And also, you know, if you're not going to pick up your phone when we call you, then that number.
Good one there.
Right.
Abhinav, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this discussion, and I think you've covered a lot of practical ground, some good insights, some good tips. And I'm sure the students who tune into this session will really benefit from, you know, the advice and the good words that you've shared. So thank you so much for that.
I'm glad that I could be of help. Again, this are just my opinions. I could be wrong, but this is just something that what I have sort of experienced through my journey. So I'm just sharing that. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the session. We really covered some practical ground, and I really enjoyed my conversation with Abhinav. I'm hoping you did too. Stay tuned for more content like that. Follow us on our channel on YouTube. Follow us on Apple Podcast or Spotify. Whatever works for you is fine. Till we meet again, we'd say, stay curious.